The thought of going to prison appeals to absolutely no one, we assume, and the thought of going to prison and being placed in solitary confinement is just chilling. Alone in a small cell, little or no view of the outside world, little contact with other people. Perhaps 100,000 Americans start and finish the day in such conditions, despite evidence that it is harmful. Our guest this hour has researched and written extensively about the subject. Terry Allen Coopers is the author of a new book called Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it. Terry Allen Coopers is a psychiatrist and a teacher of psychiatry, currently on the faculty of the Wright Institute in Berkeley. His work in forensic psychiatry includes testimony as an expert witness in lawsuits over prison and jail conditions, and he works as a consultant to Human Rights Watch. Terry Allen Coopers, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Let's start with the human rights aspect of this. Is there any other country that does as much solitary confinement as we do?
Absolutely not. The United States imprisons a larger proportion of the population than any other country. We also have a larger proportion of prisoners suffering from serious mental illness, and we use solitary confinement much more than any other country in the world.
So is there a particular theory behind putting people in solitary? Is it just a case of nothing else worked on these guys?
Well, lots of other things work. In the 1980s, the prisons were massively crowded, and they were totally out of control. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of suicide. The authorities didn't know what to do. I and other experts in corrections and criminology said what we needed to do was to downsize the prisons, stop imprisoning low-level drug offenders and cut the population by quite a lot. The population has multiplied 7 or 10 times since the 70s. And I also said we have to enhance rehabilitation programs. At the time, if you remember in the 80s, there was a call for not coddling prisoners, and the college courses in prison were cut, the Pell Grants. And rehabilitation was sharply cut back, in fact, was oversubscribed because of the growing population. Instead of heeding that advice, what the authorities did was they said, we think there's a small number of bad actors who are causing all the violence, and we're going to lock them up in a solitary confinement cell. So there started the supermax era, and they started building entire prisons made of solitary confinement cells, and they thought they were imprisoning the worst of the worst. Of course, they weren't. There were some people who were mean and tough, and some who weren't. But they put more and more people into solitary, and then they kept them there for years or even decades. And that caused immense amount of human damage. It did not change the violence rate in the prison, and it did not change the problem with gangs.
So it seems like the public was certainly having some buy into this because there were certainly three strikes laws passed in places like California. Measure 11 in Oregon was a similar sort of thing to toughen up sentences. I remember a ballot measure that passed in Oregon to require all inmates to work. So the idea of making things tougher on people in prison was certainly in vogue in the 80s and 90s.
Yes, and you know it was a foolhardy plan because in fact, what happens when people are put in solitary is that they're damaged and their social skills, for instance, deteriorate. When they get out of solitary, they actually get into more trouble than they would have otherwise. So it wasn't a very good plan, but it does a certain PR job, and that is there's this portrayal of the criminal who goes to prison as a heinous criminal, and we need to be kept safe, and what we need is a higher budget for our police force and build more prisons. And there was a concerted effort to do that in the 80s and 90s, and putting people in solitary created an image of this absolutely uncontrollable, violent individual. Actually, when you walk into solitary confinement units, which I do in preparation for testimony in class action lawsuits, what I meet is very ordinary people, not especially violent. Some are very smart, some aren't so smart, some are very kind, and some are mean, just like out in the community at large. They're not a different population, but they're harmed by all the time they spend in solitary.
But the question that gets down to for a lot of people, I think, is if an inmate does not comply and is capable of hurting other inmates, how do you deal with that person without locking them up all alone?
Well, the answer is to meet their needs, whatever their needs are. Now, over 50% of prisoners today have a serious mental illness. So that means supply mental health treatment, a quality mental health treatment, which is also insufficient in prison. Some people have trauma from their past. A lot of prisoners have very severe trauma in their childhood, in their adulthood, before incarceration. And what we should be doing is some kind of trauma-informed rehabilitation program so they can process the trauma rather than resorting to illicit substances, for instance. There are all kinds of rehab programs that work. Generally, if you give someone a job or a meaningful training program in prison, they're not going to get in trouble because they don't want to give up their slot in the program. So we should be supplying that kind of programming to all of the prisoners. I think the solution is to massively downsize the prisons and then to create adequate programming, rehabilitation, mental health treatment, education for the prisoners who are left. And I promise the violence rate will go down. We had an experience in Mississippi where there was a class action lawsuit. It was called Presley versus Epps. And as a result of the lawsuit, we downsized, the Mississippi Department of Corrections downsized the Supermax unit and eventually closed it. We studied the effect on the entire prison population in Mississippi's Department of Corrections and found that actually the violence rate system and number of disciplinary tickets, they write tickets for people who break rules, the violence and the rate of ticket writing went down drastically after the Supermax was closed.
All right, let's pick up the story on the other side of a
break. The opposite of why they say they're building these places.
Okay, Terry Allen Cooper is our guest. His book is called Solitary. It is about solitary confinement. We'll come back and resume the discussion with Terry Allen Cooper and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is psychiatrist and teacher of psychiatry, Terry Allen Cooper, who has visited many prisons over the years and observed many sets of conditions, has testified as an expert witness in lawsuits over prison and jail conditions, and has written another book critical of solitary confinement. The book is called Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. So you know where he's coming from. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to get into the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Terry, let's get into some definitions here, as you do early in the book. You say there's no such thing as total isolation. So then what conditions do constitute solitary?
Well, solitary confinement is generally being alone in a cell, and the cell contains a toilet, a sink, and usually a bunk bed. It's very small. There's hardly room to walk past the bed to get to the sink or the toilet, and the toilet is just a foot or two from your head when you're asleep. Very few amenities. They're allowed few books. Some segregation units allow the prisoners to have television and radio. Some do not. Some have windows. Some do not. Some are entirely enclosed. Some have solid metal doors so that you're basically a closet-like space, and the lights are on. Unfortunately, the lights stay on during the night, too. So that's the condition. So people are very idle and alone in that kind of cell. And the Supermax idea is that they build entire cell blocks or prisons full of these isolation cells. People get out for a few hours a week. I think the current mandate across the country on average is they should get out five times a week for an hour to do recreation. But the recreation is usually alone in a space that's hardly bigger than the cell and has no athletic equipment.
All right. So you have gone to the likes of Crescent City, Pelican Bay, rather, near Crescent City, California.
Yes, Pelican Bay.
And that was built to be a supermax, wasn't it?
Yes. Pelican Bay State Prison in California is half supermax. It's got about 1,500 cells that are supermax, or 1,500 prisoners. Some of them are double-celled in supermax, and about 1,500 prisoners who were on the general population yard, which is a very high-security, tough place.
All right. So what do you make of the places that have been built like Crescent City to be? I mean, they were built as the idea of Supermax was really coming into heavy practice in the prison system.
Yes. Well, it had its day. That is, in the 90s, most states built them. Over 40 states built Supermax prisons, and the federal system built one at the ADX in Florence, Colorado. But in recent years, I would say the last decade or two, correctional authorities have become disillusioned with Supermax. They feel it was a mistake, it costs too much money, and the people they keep in them are too damaged. Meanwhile, there's very little improvement in the violence rate or the disciplinary problems in the prison at large. I didn't quite answer your last question about isolation. It is isolation. I described the cell. But there's a lot of noise. It's not quiet. It's not like a sensory deprivation unit. The doors open and close by remote control, metal doors clanging all the time. Officers yell orders. People, particularly people with mental illness, yell a lot of the day, including the night. So it's not solitary in an absolute sense, but what's lacking is meaningful social engagement. So having an officer come by and pass a food tray through the slot in the door is not really meaningful social interaction. So I consider it very isolative and very solitary, but correctional authorities sometimes complain that because the officer comes by and passes a food tray, it's not exactly solitary.
So what do you see happening in the minds of people who are kept in these kinds of conditions?
Well, I've probably interviewed 500 or 1,000 people in this situation around the country in various class, in preparation for various class action lawsuits. There's a number of symptoms that regularly are reported by people who are relatively stable from a mental health perspective. And that includes very high anxiety, which can take the form of panic attacks, difficulty thinking, which often takes the form of paranoia, difficulty concentrating, difficulty with memory, severe sleep problems. In this kind of a situation, almost nobody can sleep. Despair. People say that I'm never going to get out of here. And for instance, I interview people who have a six-month stint in solitary. They've had a disciplinary ticket for breaking a prison rule or getting in a fight, and they were put in solitary for 6 months. I go to visit them, and they tell me they're never going to get out of here. And I say, well, you've only got a six-month stint. And they tell me, yes, but if I get another ticket while I'm in solitary, they will give me an additional 6 months, and then onward from there. And in fact, one of the symptoms that's frequently reported is growing anger, irrational anger, because when I ask the prisoners what they're so angry about, they give me different answers. They try to understand the anger, but the truth is it just grows when you're in solitary. And then they're very afraid they're going to get into an argument with an officer and get another ticket, which will extend their time. The despair is just stunning. We have a statistic that 50% of successful suicides in prison, in all prison systems, average, occur among the 4 or 6 or 8% of the population that are in solitary. So it's pretty much a precursor or a cause of suicide. And the despair is just ever present.
Terry Allen Cooper is again our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You wrote an earlier book, Terry, Prison Madness, in 1999. Has much changed since that time?
Well, I outlined the problem of solitary at that time. But what's really happened is that more and more prisons are using solitary confinement as their model. So, for instance, in a maximum security prison, which is not solitary, the time that prisoners are allowed to be out of their cells and roaming in the day room or going to a job or going to the yard has been decreasing incrementally. So in some prisons, the people in general population only get 2 or 4 or 5 hours a day out of their cell. So more and more prisons are starting to look like solitary confinement, and in fact, some of the harsh effects of solitary confinement are happening in the general population units.
So has the movement towards solitary confinement solved any of the problems that corrections officials wanted to solve through more use of it?
Well, you know, it has a certain groundswell to it. So if you want to talk tough about crime, you want to lock them up and throw away the key and tough prosecutors, tough politicians, tough correction officers will say that these prisoners we take care of are extremely mean, they're heinous criminals, they're impossible to control, and we need solitary confinement to control them. That is the argument. Now, I think there are situations where solitary or segregation, as it used to be called, need to be used for a little time. For instance, after there's been a major incident, maybe some violence or a murder, some people need to be put in a cell by themselves so the warden can figure out what's going on. That should be extremely time limited and only involve a very few people and happen on rare occasions. Instead, we've got 100,000 people locked in solitary. Many, for instance, at Pelican Bay State Prison, it opened in 1990, and when we did the lawsuit, Ashker versus Brown, a couple of years ago, many of the prisoners in the SHU, Security Housing Unit, which is the solitary supermax, had been there since the opening of the prison. So that's 25 years, and some of them had been in solitary somewhere else. This was not the original design of solitary. It has kind of deteriorated, and it's destroyed lives.
All right, so then how do you respond to the people who say, tough, this is what they earned?
I'm sorry, say that again?
How do you respond to the people who say, tough on them, this is what they earned?
Well, you know, I think we're making a huge mistake as a society, cutting back on rehabilitation and crowding our prisons, because really the question we should be asking is, what are we going to do with people who are in prison that will improve their chances when they get out of succeeding at going straight? And the question should not be how harshly can we punish them. Their prison term is the punishment. They're cut off from the community, from loved ones. They're not able to work. That's their punishment, prison. When we do further things that destroy their mind inside the prison, what we're doing is decreasing by quite a lot the chance that they are going to succeed when eventually they're released. 93% of prisoners are eventually released, so we have to be very careful that instead of in the quest to punish more and more harshly, we do things that damage them so they won't be functional when they get out of prison. That should be the criterion we use to decide what we're doing with people when they're in prison.
Terry Allen Coopers is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a psychiatrist and a teacher of psychiatry. He has been to many prisons and has observed conditions ranging from overcrowding to solitary confinement. He has testified as an expert witness in lawsuits over prison and jail conditions and works as a consultant to Human Rights Watch. His latest book is called Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Alex in Springfield. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, I'm a rehabilitation counselor and did 6 months of training at Rikers Island Prison in New York. And the first thing I was told when I arrived by an administrator is, we don't do rehabilitation here. We're all about controlling the prison population. And I saw the negative effects of that and the isolation units. And I was wondering if they have to have some degree of control, have they ever used the concept of using humorous movies to show the prisoners and comedy TV shows so they still have some interaction with via a screen, you know, of appropriate behavior and the benefit of humor?
All right. Thanks for the question.
That's an excellent point. Rikers Island, although it's called a prison, is actually a jail. It's the local detention facility for New York City. They have had a lot of trouble with solitary confinement, and particularly with juvenile prisoners. It's true that jail is a short-term incarceration. Usually it's for people who have not been tried. They're awaiting their trial, and they can't afford bail. or have been sentenced to something less than a year. So they spend that time at Rikers Island or other local jails. It's true that there isn't the budget to do extensive rehabilitation in a jail. I think that's a mistake. In New York, there was a lawsuit, Brad H. versus the New York Department of Board of Corrections. And what that lawsuit was on behalf of people with serious mental illness. In jail, even more than prison, the majority of prisoners suffer from serious mental illness. I didn't mention when I was talking about the symptoms of solitude, the symptoms I mentioned, the anxiety, the paranoia, are when in people who are relatively stable. But when people have a mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or post-traumatic stress disorder, the isolation makes their symptoms much, much worse. So the Brad H. case established, and it was agreed to by the parties, that when someone appears at Rikers Island who has not been known to the mental health system in New York previously, they need to be started on treatment in the jail. The staff needs to make arrangements after they're released that they have housing, that they have mental health treatment, et cetera. And I think that's a more reasonable use of our jails. That is, we have an opportunity when someone lands in jail to take a look at them and to see if they're suffering from a mental illness that is not treated or inadequately treated and get them started on treatment. That's a much better plan than punishing them harshly, which putting them in solitary does.
Terry Allen Coopers is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Solitary, and there's a good history lesson in here, Terry. How far back does the American fondness for solitary go?
How far back?
Yes.
Well, it goes way back. I mean, Benjamin Franklin advocated solitary confinement at the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia back at the turn of the 18th century. And his reason for it was to give people time alone to think about their errant ways. So they were supposed to be penitent in their time in a cell by themselves at the Walnut Street Jail. And the warden would come and visit them and talk to them about their plan for improving themselves. Well, eventually the Walnut Street Jail became very crowded, and that plan didn't work. And it turned out that an overcrowded population was merely warehoused in separate cells, solitary confinement. It's woven its way through correctional practices for the next two centuries. And sometimes it reaches a level where there's an objection by human rights advocates or by social workers that it's causing great harm. We've never had the kind of enthusiasm for solitary confinement that we've had since the 1990s. So this is an unprecedented high level of solitary around the country. And again, the harm is multiplied.
And you recount some fairly notable critics of solitary confinement early in the 19th century. Who were some of the people who criticized it even then?
Well, Charles Dickens was here. The French scholars came and looked at our prisons. In Pennsylvania, there was what was called the Philadelphia system, which was based on Benjamin Franklin's kind of isolation. So Eastern Pennsylvania correctional facility. And many people visited there and wrote scathing reports about how abusive it was in terms of human rights.
Even Alexis de Tocqueville apparently was one of the French intellectuals who came and looked at it.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Alexis de Tocqueville was one of the people who criticized American
yes.
solitary?
Yeah. Yes, and his writing about it is just a scathing critique of solitary confinement.
Well, it's not just facilities, as you point out in the book, it's treatment, and you do get to observe how prison workers deal with inmates, and what have you noticed in the interactions, particularly with prisoners in solitary?
Well, in the early 1970s at Stanford, there was what was called the Stanford Mock Prison Experiment, where a group of psychology students were hired as experimental subjects. Half of them were given the role of being a guard and half of them of being a prisoner, and they were put in the basement of the psychology department at Stanford. Within days, the level of abuse by the guards against the prisoners, all of these are Stanford students, But they were so abusive, withholding food, causing immense physical pain, that this experiment had to be precipitously stopped. Well, from that, we learned something that I have seen repeated in prisons around the country, and that is when you give one group of people absolute control over another group, as officers in solitary have over the prisoner population, and you give the prisoners or the group that's controlled absolutely no recourse, and the third the prerequisite is that the whole thing be secret, that is, no one has access to it or knows what's going on, then very large abuses happen. And we know that over and over again throughout history. So, for instance, in solitary confinement, there's a procedure called a cell extraction, which is equivalent in a mental hospital to a takedown, where a number of staff rush someone and bring them to the floor. In prison, solitary confinement cells, they call that a cell extraction because they have a team of five or six officers who bunch up at the door of the cell, and they're wearing what I call ice hockey uniforms. They've got padding over all their bodies.
All right, Terry, hang on a second. I want to hear more about extraction. We have to take a break right now. Solitary is the book. Terry Allen Cooper is the author and our guest. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the psychiatrist Terry Allen Cooper, who teaches psychiatry at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. He has done a lot of work with prisons over the years, visiting prisons, testifying as an expert witness on prison conditions. And he's written his second book on prison conditions called Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Terry, you were just talking about an extraction from a solitary cell. It sounds like five guys pretty much all dressed up for a riot.
That's correct. And this is called a cell extraction. And what they're doing is they're going into the cell to put someone down, to put them into restraints, because they've disobeyed an order. Usually the order was to put their hands through the food port in order to be handcuffed, or returning their food tray. I find a lot of times the prisoners complain that the food is rotten or there are bugs in the food, and they keep their tray because they want to talk to someone about it and have an improvement in the dietary system. The officers then say, okay, that's a refusal. We're going to do a cell extraction. They group five or six people. One is assigned to grab each limb of the prisoner. One of them is carrying a shield and leads the way, and the shield might have an electrical system that causes a shock that'll knock the prisoner out. Then they shoot some immobilizing gas, pepper spray, into the cell, and then they rush the person. And usually there are injuries. The plan is to push him against the far wall of the cell and then put cuffs on him. But as you can imagine, in that kind of situation, injuries occur usually to the prisoner. This happens disproportionately with prisoners who are suffering from mental illness and with prisoners of color. There's a large racial discrimination going on, so that people, black and Latino and other people of color, are disproportionately put in solitary confinement, and then they're disproportionately the object of these cell extractions.
We had a question earlier from Tim in Grants Pass who wanted to ask about not the racial composition, but the gender composition in solitary. I mean, there are far fewer women incarcerated than men. We know that much, but I assume then and is there a smaller percentage of women then who end up in solitary?
The problem in women's facilities is that the punishment regimens are those designed for the men. So, for instance, women are subjected to the same kind of shackling, the same kind of use of force. The cell extraction I described is used on women, and it's not really that necessary. Women have much lower escape risk, and they're much less difficult to manage. So they overuse force with women. 93% of prisoners are men, so 7% are women. The racial composition of prisoners is a reflection of a racism in our society at large. There are 13% African Americans in the population at large, but there's between 40 and 50% of prisoners who are African American. Likewise with Latino, I think it's 15 or 20% of prisoners are Latino. And then again, as I said, a disproportionate number of them are sent to solitary, whereas people who have the same behavior problems who are white are more likely to be identified as mentally ill and sent into treatment rather than solitary.
You mention in the book that you have been asked often if you are anti-officer, and what is your response to that question?
Well, it's a complicated question because being an officer in a prison is an extremely difficult job. I think that a large number of officers mean well. They went into being an officer, a correction officer, in order to help people. And many officers do help people. They talk to prisoners, much less so in solitary. They talk to people on the yard in general population. And the amount of talk and helpful mentoring, big brother type approach is much less in solitary. Now, among the officers, there are some abusive, sadistic guards. And unfortunately, there's this dynamic. The abusive officers in the solitary context, which is a little separate unit inside the prison, tend to rise to positions of power because they're willing to use force and to make harsh kind of interactions with the prisoners. So they rise to power, and the other officers will not say anything when they do something abusive. So I've investigated a lot of sexual abuse cases. For instance, in women's prisons, it's usually staff who are raping or sexually abusing the women prisoners. What's interesting is that I always find other officers who were in the vicinity and knew about the rape or the sexual abuse and did not report it. They have what's called a blue code that officers will not inform on each other. It's very much like the no snitch rule that the prisoners have in their prisoner code. And so what happens is that the abusive and sadistic and sexual perpetrator guards are not halted by their colleagues, and then they take control of the unit. And that's why we hear all the awful stories of abuse.
Let's take a call here. We have Chuck in Klamath Falls on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the author of Solitary, Terry Allen Coopers. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I just wanted to say when I was teaching public school in 1955 to 60 in Marin County, I was also part-time teaching at San Quentin Prison during their great population explosion because they were trying to build other facilities, and we had the whole mixture. And we were trying to rehabilitate people, and our experience then was very different, and we had a superintendent there who said that you not only had to accept people's messing up three times, but maybe five or six times before they got the message. There was a more of a compassionate operation going on. And I wondered what happened. I think that sociologically, why we had Governor Reagan, who was more working on the fear-mongering, and things began to trend differently. But it's very disappointing to hear the trend that's gone on today and then the expansion even further.
All right.
So I appreciate hearing this today. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you for your question. That's a very apt comment. Things have gotten meaner and more cruel in the prisons. I think it's a sign of the times. Our society has become more harsh and less caring towards disadvantaged people of all kinds. In fact, I think we've reneged on our social contract that government should be providing services to the most disadvantaged among us, for instance, housing. But look at the large number of homeless people in the richest country in the world. There's been a successive dismantling of the public social safety net, and mental health services are a big part of that, so that public mental health, although it exists, has been relatively defunded. So the large number of people suffering from serious mental illness are not getting the treatment or wraparound services like housing and vocational training that they need in the community, and that's why they run afoul of the law. We lock them up in unprecedented numbers, so reports are that 56% or more of prisoners are suffering from serious mental illness. And then what we've done is we've disappeared the problem. Rather than face the rather upsetting reality that this society is not providing services for the most disadvantaged among us, instead we disappear them into prison, the whole idea of lock them up and throw away the key. And that has been going on more and more since the 70s, when this country, lost some of the post-World War II affluence. The economy relatively shrunk, or the gap between rich and poor became much wider, so that poor people were doing a lot less well, and many were running afoul of the law and being locked in prison. The society has locked them away or disappeared them rather than deal with their needs. And that's why we're in such a jam today with a large prison population and not enough treatment or rehabilitation going on.
So I noticed that among the steps that you list for correcting corrections as they exist today, mental health care outside of the prison context is not on that list. But I assume the way you're talking, that would be you'd want to see the mental health system beefed up as well as things made different within the walls of the prisons.
Yes. In psychiatry, in public mental health, we have a huge problem with what's called dual diagnosis. That is, people with serious mental illness tend to also be have some substance abuse in their history. So when laws are created that are hard on people with substance abuse problems, for instance, the war on drugs, and when we lock up a large number of people whose only crime is related to substance abuse, we disproportionately select people with mental illness and send them to prison. So that's one population. Another is juveniles. We're locking juveniles up in unprecedented numbers, either trying them as adults, and this can be for relatively minor crimes, or just arresting them more. Again, there's a racial aspect to this, and that is that children of color are more likely to run into trouble with the police and be victimized by the police. So they end up in prison in unprecedented numbers. And so what we're doing is we're disappearing the populations that, for instance, the mental health problem, we don't supply adequate public mental health. And the kids, our public education system is failing. They're being bumped out, and they get in trouble on the streets. So all of the imprisonment binge is really just a mirror of how poorly we're doing in terms of providing us a public social safety net.
Speaking of mental health, there are photographs in the book, and one in particular that really grabbed my attention. And then I went back and realized it's also on the dust jacket of the book, and it's a picture of inmates at San Quentin in group therapy, and they're all sitting in a room together, but they're all in individual cages, which is quite a stark picture.
Yes, and that's why we put it on the cover. That picture is quite ordinary for people who work in a prison. That picture happens to be at San Quentin. And high security prisons, I'm talking about maximum security, not supermax isolation. High security prisoners are seen by mental health staff and teachers only when they're put in a cage. And these cages, they're called therapeutic cubicles, but the prisoners call them cages, and they feel like they're being treated like an animal. They're basically telephone booth-shaped devices, and prisoners are let into them in shackles one at a time and seated or standing in their cage, and then the group leader or the teacher comes in, and there will be five of these cages in a room, and then a therapy session or a class goes on. It's overkill. There are maybe a handful of prisoners who I've met in my 40 years doing this work who I would be afraid to be in a room alone with. But these cages are being used for hundreds of thousands of prisoners around the country. It's, again, a PR drive, and that is that the correction officers and the legislators who support being harsher on crime want to say that these are horrible people who are unmanageable, they're incorrigible, they're violent. That's not really true. That does not fit the people that I find when I go into the prison and talk to them.
So the first step you list, and we're not going to have time to get all the steps in here to correcting corrections, is to end the cycle of hostility. How? What steps do you recommend within that step?
Well, there are many ways to do it. What happens is that officers, the more harsh the punish the situation, like supermax isolation, the harder the staff is on the prisoners, because they're afraid that any misbehavior by the prisoner could get out of control and their unit could be out of order. So what they do is they create more and more rules and more punishments, which become harsher and harsher. So I described the cell extraction. That's officially not supposed to be a punishment, but in practice it is a punishment. If the prisoner misbehaves, they do a cell extraction. They basically beat them up and shoot them with pepper spray. So what's happening is that becomes the only way the officers have to relate to prisoners. They don't really have a conversation anymore. They don't act as big brother. They don't talk to them about what's going on with their children or encourage them to study. Rather, they just punish them every time a rule has been broken. To reverse that, there needs to be a zero-tolerance attitude on the part of authorities, the warden or the commissioner of the state, that we are not going to allow abusive practices and the overuse of force in our prisons. And there needs to be a respectful interaction between staff at every level and the prisoners. So, for instance, I give the example of the solitary confinement unit up in Washington.
Terry, we have to go. I'm sorry, we don't have time for the example there, but staff training critical there, you say. It's worth a read. The book is called Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. Terry Allen Cooper is our guest on The Exchange today. Thank you so much for that.